Excellent. So we are back in JavaScript world with the engine, some of the engine people. We talked to you guys at PDC09, and we're really excited because we learned that you were developing a new JavaScript engine that will ship as part of IE9. Mix 10 is now over, and Dean told us about Chakra, code name for this project. So we wanted to come in and kind of go deep with you guys and figure out what is it, what is new about it, what the architecture, etc. So without further ado, go ahead and introduce yourselves in Channel 9 style.
I'm not exactly sure what Channel 9 style is.
Well, it means that you introduce yourself rather than me formalize the introductions.
Excellent. Good. So the clarity is there. Yes. As opposed to like making up a name and a title.
Totally.
All right. I'm John Montgomery. I'm the group program manager for the JavaScript engine and tools.
Awesome.
I'm Chuck Kuniogi. I'm the general manager of the same team.
Okay.
And I'm Steve Luco. I'm the architect of that team.
Excellent. So tell us, what's going on here? What is new about this engine?
Well, with Mix, we now have actually a version of the engine that developers can actually use.
Download
the IE9 platform preview. We've made a lot of progress since PDC, and some of that you kind of saw at Mix, and we'll be talking a bit more about that today. We're continuing to make progress on performance, but we've really been putting in the kind of key pieces of the architecture for the JavaScript engine, including a new kind of background compilation feature that allows you to both interpret and compile JavaScript, and then lots of improvements across the board in the JavaScript engine. And we've also been focused on getting the engine actually running the web. So going from having the basics of the engine design to actually having something that can run all the JavaScript out there today. Turns out that's actually a lot of hard work to make it compatible.
So let's talk a little bit about, so you're talking about the dual execution pipeline, which is one way to describe this. Dean talked about that at Mix. Why, first of all, let's talk about what that is, and then talk about why you decided on that architecture versus just go to syntax, compile the blob, and run it, as opposed to run it line by line by line, which was an interpreter does. Let's talk about your architecture and the thinking behind it and kind of dig into it.
Okay. So one of the things we've been enjoying learning about in the last 6 to 9 months as we've gotten into this project is how different web pages behave. And there are many different things on the web now that you interact with on a daily basis. There are things like, say, your popular news sites, CNN or New York Times or something like that. And then there's also things like Gmail or Hotmail. And these things actually behave quite differently. And what we're trying to do is make sure that whenever you click something, mm-hmm. you get a response right away. The web just pops. So as soon as you want to navigate to something, you see the new site right away. As soon as you interact with, say, a feature like a menu or something on Amazon, boom, you see it right away. So what we wanted to do was balance investing in preparing script to run really fast, mm-hmm. For things like web applications like email, but also take some script, the script that comes down with the initial page where you're getting to see the pictures and see everything, mm-hmm. and run it right away, which is what an interpreter does. So what we did was we made a dual execution path. We made a way to have the script come down and be able to run right away. Meanwhile, we took the other pieces of script. And if there's a spare core or if there's a pause in what people are doing, we take advantage of that to prepare that script to run super fast. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, in the case of Gmail, there's an initial burst where we're loading the UI, the interface, the thing that you see. And then there's another about 400 milliseconds, fraction of a second, where it's preparing your inbox. What we want to do is make that time as short as possible so that you see your inbox and can work with it as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. So while we're putting up the UI and using our interpreter to run the script that does that, we're meanwhile using another core to prepare the script that's going to assemble your inbox and run your filtering rules and so on and get it ready for you to interact with in the background. So that okay. then you get to see the UI, decide what you're going to do, and then when you decide to do it, boom, it's there. It responds to you right away because we've taken the more compute-intensive parts of the script and compiled it.
Okay.
So we've actually done a bunch of work to make the interpreter itself faster. Right? So when you load up these pages and it starts running in the interpreter, a lot of script, especially like we've seen a lot of pages in their startup, it's only about 10 to 30% of the time that's used in starting up the page is actually script. And so a lot of times if we're running with a fast interpreter, we can kind of go do that. But at the same time, if there's more script intensive stuff to kind of go bring in, by putting that on a background core, we can actually not have, you know, your page have to block for script to be prepared into code. Okay. And instead you can have, you know, these other, the other core kind of go and do, you know, high quality code generation based stuff.
And one of the nice things that this enables us to do is it gives us a little bit more time, since many, many web pages don't actually execute all the JavaScript code that comes down.
True.
It gives us a little bit more time to kind of look at the page, look at the layout, look at the code that's come down, and say, you know what, we're only using these functions, so these are the ones that we're going to JIT. The rest of them, you know what, we'll keep interpreting them, leave them alone.
Fair enough. So method JIT is what you're talking about. Now let me ask you a question before you answer that. Something has to do the analysis. So in some sense, you have to analyze to get an understanding of what's happening. That's not for free. That requires computing. So how did you get that to happen so fast? In other words, I wouldn't call it necessarily static analysis, but you are analyzing what you think the code patterns are going to be or what they are. What kind of challenge like that, and how computing intensive is that operation itself?
So that's a great question. One of the things we can do is that we can put a small amount of instrumentation code in the interpreter. So for taking less than 1% of the total time that the interpreter takes, we can measure things like when you branch back to the beginning of a loop, say, in a program, we can say, well, okay, we're going to count how many times those backward branches happen. And then we can use things like that to dictate how we know what is the most important stuff to compile. So we might let some of the functions run in the interpreter for a few times, and then we see, okay, this is what is really being used a lot. Okay. And so we can then apply more computing resources in the background to getting that to run really fast. So the interpreter actually, while it's showing you things and bringing the UI up and responding to you, is also taking a little bit of its time to squirrel away information that we can then use to determine what we should invest in preparing for faster execution.
Okay, now
you kind of mentioned the term like method JIT. I think often what you see in things where methods are being kind of on-demand JITed is because they're kind of done in line this way, right? They tend to trade off a lot of the really good quality analysis you can do in order to kind of just do very quick code generation, right? Mm-hmm. And so what you get is these methods with fairly low quality code. And we've kind of taken a bit of a different approach, where rather than kind of take it within those limitations, because we're using this level of analysis and then using background compilation, we can actually go figure out, you know, what order to go compile things in order to kind of get the best performance. Mm-hmm. But then when we're compiling, also be able to generate higher quality code, while the same code may be actually running in interpreted mode.
Awesome.
In the main thread.
Now, we have very clean whiteboards. We have an architect, we have a group program manager, and a GM. Can we draw some pictures? So, let's put it to you this way. I'm a simpleton, right? I need pictures.
Ooh, cool.
So
I'm a simpleton.
So
I can probably give you some pictures. That
cool. So, let's look at it like JS comes in. There's JS. Now, draw what happens to the point of
so. What I can do,
I'll
give you the simple version, and then
Steve can
tell me that I'm an idiot, and I've completely oversimplified it, and fix it.
Cool.
Because that's actually kind of how we work, now that I think.
Interesting. Well, he gets to have a marker, too, then.
So we got some script that comes in. It comes in from the host. The host, in this case, is IE. The first thing that we do is we parse it. So there's a parser. The parser then generates an AST, an abstract syntax tree.
Yes.
Which we then convert into our internal bytecode.
Aha.
So this is a thing, and then immediately the interpreter starts to run it. So at the same time, there's this other little thread that's going along here. That's the compilation thread we've been talking
sure.
about. So what happens once this stuff is generated and the interpreter starts to run it is we gradually start to feed information into a little queue that's sitting here.
Okay.
That figures out the priority of what should be compiled when.
Nice.
Which then does the code gen. And as we generate the code, mm-hmm. we're basically able then to replace the stuff that's running in the interpreter gradually with the specific things that we've compiled to boost the performance.
Okay.
So that's the... And now we'll get the corrected version
from the architect. Distinguished engineer to boot.
Actually, wow, I was hoping you'd make a big mistake so I could taunt you, but...
I was building up for the big mistake.
He was nervous.
If you want, I can actually go in and make some mistakes now.
That was actually so good, I don't have anything good to taunt you with. But I can add a few more details. So,
sure.
So one thing is, in addition... So first of all, one thing, this looks sort of long, right?
Yes.
You're wondering, well, why is this immediate? Well, this actually takes only a fraction of the time that CodeGen takes. So really, even though there's a lot of boxes here, you're talking about one-tenth the time to go through this pipeline that it takes to go through this one.
Okay.
Okay, and so there's an art to figuring out when you want to invest the energy to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that art has to do not just with... where are the hot parts of the functions, where is the computation being done,
mm-hmm.
but also the conditions, the situation, like how many cores do I have to invest, how much am I on battery, for example. If I'm on battery, I want to do less of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the things that has been fun for us has been looking at all different kinds of systems, you know, netbooks, big laptops plugged in,
mm-hmm.
or desktops and so on, and with four cores,
mm-hmm.
and being able to adapt to those different situations. You're almost out of battery, you've got a full battery, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
And decide how much of each of these things to invest in to give the best experience we can.
Sure.
So some of the things that also happen here is flowing off of here are also the regular expressions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also... going on in the background, we're going to speed up your pattern matching. So one of the things that JavaScript developers like to do is write patterns, because
mm-hmm.
there's just a lot of data on the web, and the data comes in and they want to shred it apart into little pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we've invested in is being able to analyze regular expressions and run those patterns really fast. But again, we don't want to do that at the expense of showing you something.
Okay.
We want to respond to you, the person clicking on something, right away. And so we want to say, okay, if we have the opportunity to invest in running these things faster, we will, but not at the expense of slowing down this pipeline, because
Steve,
this pipeline is what's going to show you things.
I mean, you said we saw like a site where there were, you know, several hundred regular expressions, but only a couple that were being used.
That's right.
You know, having all that stuff be compiled before your page runs.
I saw a website that downloaded more than 10,000 regular expressions and used 4 in loading the page. So you have to be very careful
mm-hmm.
about doing only those things that are necessary to respond to what the user of the web page is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been an education for us. We've had to learn looking at the top 300 websites, looking at some of the websites that... are very interactive, like maps or email clients. We've had to learn how do those things behave, and even that they behave in phases,
mm-hmm.
and make sure that our dual execution pipelines adapt to that.
Excellent. Now, we just recently had on Channel 9, since you mentioned that, I mean, you guys work, people sometimes will wonder, how does MSR work with product teams? Well, the JS Meter paper that was written by Ben Zorn and Ben Lipschitz,
yep.
we talked about that on Channel 9. Lots of amazing information in there. I'm sure you guys utilize that as well.
So we did. As a matter of fact, I've known Ben Zorn for over 20 years. He and I went to school together.
Nice.
And so we've talked about this quite a bit. And I really appreciate all the great work Ben did to study real-world web pages.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he established, beyond a doubt, is that real-world web pages don't behave anything like web benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
And so... we really have two tasks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one is to use the benchmarks the way they're intended to be used, which is to bring up the overall speed of the engine and make sure that all the different cases are being covered. But we also have to be aware that there's a lot more types of behavior of web pages, as Ben and Ben's
mm-hmm.
work shows,
absolutely,
than is captured by the benchmarks.
Mm-hmm.
So. The problem at first, you might just look at the benchmark and you're like, okay, I can get that. But then it turns out to be a much broader problem with many
it's
different.
It's broader than JavaScript too, right? Because when you look at the, you know, a lot of these sites that we've measured, we try to measure like what's the impact of all the different subsystems of the browser. You've got, you know, script, layout, rendering, parsing, network, and you know, across the board of the web, the numbers actually vary, you know, quite a bit. And that's why, you know, the set of investments we're making across IE are not just, you know, not just in JavaScript, but also thinking about, you know, how do we use GPU for rendering and things like that.
I mean, even when you just look at the way people use web pages, one of the most common scenarios is you get a link in email, you click the link, you open a new browser instance, it loads the page, then you read whatever it was, and then you close the browser instance. So the entire performance of that, like if JavaScript is nil relative to I have to start the browser, render the page, and then close the browser down. So when you compare and contrast with a benchmark that is doing the sustained execution for, you know, a minute of just beating your CPU at 100% to like run stuff as fast as it can, very few, if any, applications actually do that. So they are a class of application, but they don't actually represent like common browsing patterns.
Interesting. So I have a question based on your drawings there. And today, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't have a machine anywhere in my house or at work that has less than 2 cores. So I have a 4-core machine, looking to get an 8-core machine. So let's pretend like, you know, most people are running 8 cores. Are you guys going to take advantage of all those cores? And if that is true, I mean, would you be able to be faster by just compiling on 8 cores at the same time than interpreting anything?
Well,
that's my question.
I think the couple of things there. One is JavaScript today and the way programming in the browser is done is basically single-threaded, right?
Sure.
So almost all JavaScript that you write is basically, you know, run from point A to point B. So a lot of the things that we're trying to do from the JavaScript engine perspective is look at in things like preparing script or figuring out how to run, you know, regular expressions faster and things like that, where can we actually, you know, parallelize some work and use other cores. Now, at the whole browser and whole system level, it's like you never want the one thing on the machine that says, hey, like, I've got 16 cores, let me use them all and peg them all at 100%.
Sure.
And so that's where we also like to think of, hey, where are the things that we can optimize but then also be kind of good citizens as part of the overall, you know, overall operating system. And what's interesting is for a browser, there each of the subsystems kind of has a role there. Like in the case of rendering, you know, we're aggressively taking advantage of the GPU to kind of move stuff off the CPU so that someone else can use that CPU time. And I think some of the you know, demos that Dean showed with video and things like that are a good example of you know, what happens when you say, hey, I'm going to play a video and I'm going to just take up all the CPU I need to do that versus figuring out the right balance.
No, I mean, that's a great point. I think in some sense, I mean, it should, at least in my understanding, this actually is sort of a novel architecture for a JavaScript virtual machine, because in some sense, you could be running your analysis in parallel with what's actually really happening and then storing that information and then compiling if you need to and doing what you just told us about. That could actually be applied to other virtual machines that don't do that today, that would just take a whole blob of stuff, JIT it, and execute it, namely like the CLR.
Well, I think,
so it's really interesting, the architecture you guys have come up with. Are other teams looking at this and going,
I think that, you know, our first focus has been obviously making i9 great.
Of course.
Right? And so as part of that, we're learning a lot. Like, we're still, you know, in terms of looking at what kind of things you can kind of do in the background, you know, how code kind of gets better over time and execution. Like, those are things that we're still kind of learning. I think one of the unique things about the problem space in the JavaScript world is we don't have a lot of that kind of static type information that you might with a, you know, with a IL-based application or,
sure,
or it's something where compilation is done statically. And so in an architecture like this, we can actually use some of that. For us to be able to run that well, we need to kind of observe that over time and do the kinds of things that we were talking about in terms of, you know, how code is running, or, you know, how much of your web page gets run,
sure,
or, you know, what things kind of get used, and figure out how we can apply that data, you know, dynamically to make make things run better or faster.
Absolutely. Now, JavaScript is of course, a dynamic language, right? It's a dynamic language with functional tendencies. There's plenty of other languages out there that just happens that JavaScript is the one that most people use. So, I mean, you know, in some sense, I guess what I'm trying to ask is the notion of more of a generic virtual machine that could take any input, JavaScript or Python or whatever, and you guys could run it through your magic as well. I mean, I'm not trying to say, are we working on that kind of stuff? Does that make sense?
Well, I think that's great. It's great you're thinking that way, and I can definitely imagine a future where something like that might happen, but right now we're completely focused on making I9 great.
I understand.
And of course we have a lot of friends on the CLR team. I hired one of their partner architects, for example, to Microsoft, so there's a lot of history there and a lot of collaboration.
Cool.
But we just, basically this year is about making I9 great.
Understood. Well, this is going deep, so I like to throw kind of crazy questions out.
Well, I think one of the things I'd also say is, like, when we think about what's actually driving the changes into the engine, mm-hmm. it's actually not necessarily the engine design. Mm-hmm. It's actually the data that we're getting running real web pages, right? So I think there is a challenge with, you know, building something that's tuned reasonably well for a lot of things, but mm-hmm. then when you look at exactly what the web is, like, we find a lot of cases that are where it's like, hey, there are these three sites that are doing something that we never figure out just from a general purpose design how to do that well. Like the 800 regexes or 10,000 regexes.
10,000.
Steve talked about, for example.
Yeah, we were in a bug triage the other day where we were going through the bugs on the engine and with somebody fresh to the team, mm-hmm. and they were looking at the bugs, and a lot of the bugs came up with, well, that's, like, why would anybody ever do that? That's a stupid, like, no developer would write that.
Oh, yeah?
And that was the problem, is like, yeah. that's actually from a real site, that actually happened.
Cool. So let me ask you a question. I mean, you talked about regular expressions, those can be heavyweight, so you're doing really smart things. What about eval? Remember eval? Of course you know eval. What does eval do in this JavaScript engine?
Well, I like the way you say eval. It sounds almost like evil.
It is evil, isn't it? Or at least it used to be.
Well, so one of the advantages of having two different execution paths is that you can make a decision when you do eval. Mm-hmm. So if you have a small fragment to eval, it's much faster to just run it through the interpreter than to do a heavyweight code generation for it. Mm-hmm. But if you have a big piece of code that's evaled more than once and you can generate code for a template of it, you want to do that. So we actually do both. We sometimes generate code for eval. We often interpret eval. Eval is one of a number of evil features that JavaScript has. Another one being, one of my favorites to complain about is that from any function, you can get the arguments of any other function on the stack, at least the innermost. Huh. So if I'm in function G, I can say f.arguments, and if there's an invocation of f up on the stack, it will tell me the real arguments of that function that's on the stack. You know, so like if you're in G,
uh-huh.
and then f's up here, and then what was passed to f was like 3, you can say f.arguments in here, and sub-0, and it will actually give you this 3.
Interesting.
Okay, that is kind of a funny thing, and it kind of works when everything is just a slow, simple interpreter that's sort of done in a straightforward way to match the spec.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're actually trying to make it run super fast, those types of features can be really difficult. And like John said, those features, every one of them is used heavily on some site. In fact, we were just the other day working on reducing working set when you have these arguments objects, because we were doing sort of a naive thing, like a sort of straightforward thing for them, and we found, wow, that's creating a lot of objects.
Mm.
And so we had to adjust the way we were implementing this arguments feature in order to reduce its impact on memory use.
Okay.
So what we found is that JavaScript is a very colorful, rich experience with a lot of quirky things and then a lot of very valuable things. For example, its dynamic type system is a great match for DHTML. The fact that you can just stick expando properties on DOM nodes has been very useful to a lot of the JavaScript frameworks that have come out, like jQuery. And so it's a mixed bag. Some of it is great and really appropriate for the web setting, and some of it has been really challenging to make run fast.
Excellent. Now, at Mix, we were fortunate to have Doug Crockford show up. We invited him, and he came, and he did an incredible talk, as he normally does, on the history of the what he says is the most loved language and also the most hated at the same time. And he calls it JavaScript or ECMAScript. We had some really great conversations. I'd love to get him in a room like this someday with us. But one of the things that we talked about was, hey, what can you do at the language level to make it a little easier for the guys writing the machines, right? And one of the things that he doesn't want to do is add threads. I guess that would be more useful for developers, not machine guys. But, you know, he's like, I don't want to do that. And his main concern today is security. So we talked about security. And so I want to ask you guys that. So I'm kind of rounding, going into a question. What have you guys done in the engine for security? JavaScript, you know, has been... Let's talk about it. Security?
There are a couple of things. I think there's, at the engine level, and any time you build a new runtime to run code, and you've got, you know, for when you think about a user's machine, there's code coming in off the web, and you're basically not just running that code, but you're also potentially compiling that code and running it. You know, that's a thing that we take very seriously in terms of making sure that that's kind of being built the right way.
Sure.
And so there's a bunch of things that we're doing there in terms of the way the engine is being engineered and tested, and things like that around security. But more from at a higher level, it's really about the web is kind of this world of, you know, content and code kind of mashed together, whether it's, you know, things like ads or you know, components that you get from some script library somewhere and throw it onto your page. And all of that kind of runs in your browser. And when you create a page that kind of mashes up things from different places, you're basically inviting all those things to come and run code and basically play in the space of your page. And so that's an area that there's a bunch of conversation, you know, that Scott Isaacs and Alan Worsbrock on our team have been
awesome.
Having and with the ECMA folks, as well as with, you know, obviously with folks like Doug. There's a web sandbox prototype that Scott has there that you can go check out.
Absolutely.
It has a bunch of it has a model for basically rewriting not just JavaScript but also HTML and CSS to kind of run it safely within a sandbox.
Cool. And that's the kind of the boring stuff, security. Matt, I mean, let's get back to the virtual machine because that's the cool stuff. How do you determine, I mean, what if my question would be, as a developer, let's pretend that I want to ask the IE virtual machine to not interpret, just compile. Let's say that I'm a Lars Bok follower, and I agree with him 100% that you never need to JIT, you never need bytecode, that's all crazy. Just take my code, compile it. Next.
So,
is there a way for me to say that to you, to say, do that?
No.
Okay.
And the reason is very simple.
Yeah.
The runtime engine always knows more than the developer about what's going on at the runtime.
Of course.
So the history of programming languages and runtimes is littered with examples of language engineers trying to add instructions to tell the runtime to do things. Mm. And invariably what happens is something changes, like the runtime gets faster. Like, you know, let's imagine that through some magical leap, all of a sudden we find that we can increase the speed of compilation, you know, 500x. At that point, we would adjust the heuristics of the entire engine to say, you know what, at this point, we will shift the load and say, like, it makes a lot more sense to compile things. Or, let's say we make the converse. Like, all of a sudden, we come out with a breakthrough in interpretation that makes interpretation as fast as compilation. And so we would adjust the heuristics in the engine to say, based on whenever you give the developer the opportunity to control that kind of low-level stuff that the runtime actually knows best at runtime, because we are compiling and running the code, it's all very late bound. You know, basically, the more power you have to be very cautious about the power you put in the developer's hands to actually control runtime behaviors, like low-level behaviors, like
especially
that.
On the web. I mean, because you're getting your source from everywhere.
Well, we have 6 billion test cases in existence, and then you know, everybody every day they're creating more and they're getting richer and richer and more sophisticated. So, you know, the engine has to be able to deal well with the sites that were created in 1992 and sites that are going to be created in 2012.
And the web is itself changing, but also the things that you use to view the web is changing. Right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
The person who wrote the website 5 years ago probably didn't know that as you said, mm-hmm. most people browsing that website would be browsing it on a dual-core machine
mm-hmm.
Or higher.
Absolutely.
Today, right? And at the same time, you see netbooks and mobile devices and everything from phones to tablets kind of showing up. And building an engine that can actually adapt to some of those heuristics and kind of that we can kind of change over time to kind of do the right thing across the board is something that we're looking at very hard.
Right on, man. So on that note, thank you guys for your time.
Cool. Thanks.
Always great to come talk to you. And
thanks.
Hopefully we can come back again maybe in the next developer preview release or maybe beta or something further down the line. But thanks for your time.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.